Today, a Christian and art.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
This is a bit of a disruption in the normal topics that I do. You think to yourself, you have normal topics? Maybe not. But this is a disruption in the way I normally plan for one of our episode topics. So, and more recently, I've just swapped over to doing almost exclusively scripture, where we're just going through the book of Psalms. But I wanted to introduce this topic and introduce it as something that we could periodically return to, because on Wednesday nights at my own church, where I'm a member, I have been teaching on Wednesday nights on this topic. And it's been just to give some of our members a different way to think about art and how we experience it and why it's so valuable to us. And for those who have a reluctance to trust themselves with art, or a reluctance to trust artists with them, it is to give them a way to come at it and to see the other part of the world. And it's a really important part of the world as well. So I've been doing it on Wednesday nights, and the response, I guess, and some of the implications that it's had for people has, I think, proven to be worthwhile. And so I wanted to share it with you. So here we are, talking about some of these ideas and maybe giving a little more detail to it than I'm able to give on Wednesday nights. So when I say this, a Christian and art, I'm saying it that way because it's not very prescriptive. I'm not trying to say, this is the only way you can understand art. I am trying to say that a Christian has ways of responding to art that are informed by our Christianity. I mean, it's part of who we are. It should inform everything that we do, our Christianity, and yet shouldn't blind us to the value that art has that is permeating the culture, whether it's Christian or not. And in truth, a lot of art that has no intentional plan for leading people toward Christ or God sort of inherently does so anyway. And I'd love to talk about why that is as well as time goes by. And so to start the conversation, we just need to get a grip of what I mean when I say art. And the reason, again, I brought up the fact that I said a Christian is because if we were to look at the title of this episode, A Christian and Art, or the title of the conversation, I don't know what title Daisy will give the episode. She's a loose cannon. Anyway, the point is, a Christian is meant to imply you might respond differently than another Christian. It's not every Christian must respond this way, the Christian and art. It's not that. It's a Christian and art. I'm a Christian, so I count, so I get to call it a Christian and art. But then art, the art side, we understand what the Christian side means. The art side is a little more confusing to people. And so I just want to clarify from the start, what I mean by art is stuff that gives us the aesthetic experience. The aesthetic experience, this is very circular, what I'm about to say, but it's all you can do with it. The aesthetic experience, art, all of it is somewhat, it's sui generis. It's a thing of its own kind, and it's not like anything else exactly. And so it inherently is, or it's just naturally going to have something circular in its definition. And it is this, that art is that which gives us the aesthetic experience. And by the aesthetic experience, I mean that feeling of being in the presence of something beautiful. And so when we have that feeling, oh, wow, you know, that sense of beauty, it's because we're seeing this piece of art, this majestic portrait or whatever it happens to be. That experience, listening to a piece of music, that sensation we have, that sense of awe of being in the presence of something beautiful is what I mean by the aesthetic experience. And we have it in the presence of art. And art is different from everything aesthetic. It's, in other words, art is a particular subset of things that can create this aesthetic experience, because art is, by its nature as a term, not about, you know, the mountains. I have an aesthetic experience when I see a mountain range. I have an aesthetic experience when I see a sunset. But those are not art. You say, oh, God is making art. We'll talk about that later. But that's not a fair explanation, because art means it's artifice. It is created by man. It's something that we have produced in order and with the goal of somehow engendering this aesthetic experience. And we can talk about whether it's for that end or not a different time, but you understand what I mean. So art is something produced by us. It's artificial. And yet when we're in its presence, we have this aesthetic experience that's generated in us because it's something beautiful. I mean, we're interacting with something beautiful. And if you say, well, I know a lot of art that's not designed to be beautiful, I think you may be too narrowly defining or understanding what beauty means, because whatever produces that aesthetic experience would be in the category of the beauty that I'm talking about right now. And again, you know, we all have different ways that we use these terms. That's why I'm trying to be particular about defining it right now. So part of the nature of art that I want to talk about, and this is, I mean, you could do an entire course on the nature of art, obviously. I mean, I took a whole seminar, a whole course in my PhD studies on musical aesthetics, just musical aesthetics. And it was overwhelming. I mean, it was amazing also, genuinely revelatory. Loved the course. But my point is, we're not going to do that. So it's not like I'm going to resolve what art is. And so there's no easy solution to that. But I can give you some of the basics of what I mean by it and what we'll be talking about. So part of the nature of art is that it is expressive, meaning artists are expressing something. They're letting something out of themselves and putting it on canvas or the leaf of a book or on, you know, into a sculpture or a song or a performance, whatever it is that they're doing. They are expressing something from inside of themselves, just part of the nature of art, that it's expressive. This part's important, and artists often only sense this part. And I say that because I have artists in my life. I interact with people who are artistic. I'm not. I'm not an artist, never been an artist. This is why I'm a good person to talk about the topic, by the way, because I can't do it. And therefore, I experience it. I encounter it, and I appreciate it, but I have to appreciate it as somebody who doesn't just naturally pour art out of my fingertips. It just doesn't happen. I've had people say to me, that's not true. You have some really artistic things you've said in your sermons. But I can promise you, anytime something artistic has come out of my mouth in my speaking, it's been entirely accidental. I say a lot of things, so words are going to combine in a way that people think is artistic at times, but it will be accidental. Anyway, the point is that it's expressive, and artists love this part, obviously, because they are expressing. They should love it. I'm not even being critical of this. But sometimes artists will have a sense that it's frustrating that they're expressing all of this stuff, and nobody cares about it. Nobody listens to it. Nobody sees it. Nobody wants to read it. Nobody will come to the performance. Nobody, you know, stuff like that. And I mean, I've experienced that. I've had that feeling as a person who was trying to start a ministry. It's like, why isn't anybody coming to this thing? You know, what's wrong with these people? Can't they see how important this is to me? But you see, that the joke of that last statement, which I hope you realized was a joke, and yet very sincerely held by ministers and artists alike, is the problem. Expression is not the only thing in the nature of art. part of what makes art art is that it's relatable, that someone else can stand in the presence of it and respond to it. For an artist to express something is important, and it doesn't make the work unimportant. And if an artist just needs to express it, and I'm going to say this as an allegory, or not an allegory, but an analogy, I'm not making them equivalent. But, you know, in the same way that in therapy, you might say to someone, you need to write a letter to your father. You need to write a letter to that person who mistreated you or whatever it was. But you don't need to send it. You know, it's for you to write. That's it. It's so that you can express this thing. In the same way, it might be just so valuable for an artist to express it that that's all they do. They express it, and no one ever appreciates it. No one ever understands it. No one ever relates to it whatsoever. But it's still really valuable just as an expression. Fine. I get that. That's fine. That's not why most artists that I've encountered express the things they do. They want it to be relatable. They want others to be confronted with what they were confronted with. They want others to experience something as a result of what they experienced. And that part means the art has to be relatable. So art has both this subjective element and this objective element to it. And we're going to talk a lot about that as we go through more of the discussion. But I just wanted to start out by saying art as expression is important, but art as expression that can be relatable in some way is equally important. And for us to stand in the presence of art and experience it, it's that relatable part that we're going to be dependent on. Otherwise, we're just going to be staring at something and going, I don't know what that is. And we've all been there. I mean, we've all stood in front of a piece of art and said, I don't know what that is, but I think it's beautiful. Yeah. Don't you? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sure. That's rich. And then, you know, just hope nobody asks you any questions. We've all been there. And sometimes it's because of our own ignorance, but sometimes it's because the art's just not relatable. So it needs to be both to be the kind of art I'm talking about. An expression that came from an artist. And again, not just a statement. There's plenty where we can talk about that. But that's not what this is. We'll get to that in just a moment, that division. But just something that emerges from the artist and then something that can be received by the consumer, by the person who's consuming the art, the person who is looking at it or listening to it or watching the performance, whatever it is that's going on. So expressive, relatable, and then there is this third element. And a lot of art misses this. And so by the fact that I'm saying a lot of art misses it, you would say, well, then it's not essential to the definition. Yeah, well, sort of. I would say it's sort of proportionately, as this thing is proportionately present, it is more artistic. And it's subtlety. So art is expressive, relatable, and subtle. And I know this one sounds weird, but it's important. And it's not because we want art to be difficult. You know what I mean by subtlety? Like, you see it, and it has this impact on you, and it's kind of hard to understand why it was having this impact on it and on you. And maybe it has this meaning to it, but it's like, but that's, is that really what it means? There's a subtlety to it that makes it a challenge to sort of explain how it could be what it is. And yet, you are experiencing what it is. Why is that subtlety so important? And it is important for a fundamental reason that has to do with the definition of art, and it's partially because of a difference in understanding about what makes art valuable between, I mean, the original philosophers, right? And I just mean by that in terms of how we divide philosophy from that day forward. Plato and Aristotle, they just see what makes art art different. Plato thinks the thing that makes art artistic is its ability to represent a different layer of reality. So Plato has this, you know, he lives in this world where the non-material reality that's eternal and unchanging. So think of something like the definition of things in eternity. You know, a bed is what a bed is, even if no bed ever exists. That bed is the perfection of bedness. That's eternal bedness. Then you have beds in the world. And some of them are straight and some of them are crooked and some of them lean and some of them are soft and some are hard and some are better than others. But, you know, they are beds to the extent that they measure up to the definition of bedness that was up there in eternity, right? So this is how Plato sees the world, divided between the ideal, eternal world of forms and then this instantiated material world of objects. So the things that represent the things that are eternity, and they it's weird to describe how they interact with each other. They participate with each other in Plato's language. But a layer beyond that is where art goes. Because if a bed is in the heavens as the definition of bedness, and then there's a bed in your bedroom that you actually sleep on at night, then if some artist paints a bed, it is an artistic painting to the extent that it actually looks like the bed that looks like the definition. So by the time you get to a piece of art, you're talking about something that's two full steps removed from the most important reality, but it's also only valuable to the extent that it brings to mind that original definition that you had. So the thing that makes art art for Plato is how similar it is to the stuff that's not art. You know, that's what makes it what it is. And that's how a lot of us think about art. It's a really strong form of realism where you are looking at and you've done this, I've done this, where you look at a painting and you go, oh my soul, look how, I thought it was a photograph. This is what, you know, you've done this before, right? You've looked at a painting. At that point, you have this really weird discussion among people who are artistic or artistically minded, where they're saying, well, why are people painting anymore? You can take a picture. You know, if you can think of I can produce the same thing the artists produced in the Middle Ages. I can do it better because I have a camera. That's what some people will say. And others, obviously, and I'm among these, the others, would say, well, you don't get what's going on here, either with the artistic skill that it took to produce it and the appreciation of the time that a person spent producing it, to which, again, the original voice would say, who cares? Just, you know, it either looks better or it doesn't look better. But there is something really impressive about a person taking a brush and random pigments and producing something that makes you think you're looking in a mirror at someone's reality. That's impressive. That's, for Plato, that's what makes art art, how it represents the things that are going on in the world. By the way, it's not just about visual things. So for Plato, you know, music's ability to engender a sense of rhythm and the ability to march as you go into war is what makes music valuable. You don't want any of this random stuff the kids are putting out today. And Plato practically says that, by the way. It is an acceptance of art because of what it's not, because of what it represents, the thing it looks like, okay? Then there's Aristotle's take on that, which is not as far removed from it as sometimes we make it sound. But it is significantly removed because for him, the utility of the art for whatever's not the art is the part of it that doesn't make it art. So the more a boot is actually like a boot, meaning a piece of art that's a boot, is actually like the boot, the portion of it that's exactly like the original boot or bed is not of any value as art. It's the part of it that, it's only the part of it that makes you look at it and go, wow, that's beautiful. That's the part that makes it worthwhile as art. It is as close as you can get in their day. It is as close as you can get to our way of saying it's art for art's sake. It is the part of it that's not utilitarian. Let me go back to the sermon illustration that I was giving a moment ago, because when I speak, this is the only world in which what I do fits the category of performance of some kind. That's not why I do it, but it is present in it. Rhetorical power can be artistic. And so if I'm speaking, the part of my speaking that's just communicating information effectively is not artistic. the part of my speaking that even is artistic, that sounds beautiful, if it's lyrical or poetic or an analogy is particularly apt and leaves people with a sense of awe or something. I'm not saying I've ever achieved it. I'm just saying if that were to happen, if that happened, the extent to which it got across the point and they were able to go out and do something, you know, get this job done or understand yourself differently, would not be the artistic part. Only the part that made them go, oh, that would be the artistic part in Aristotle's way of understanding it, right? And so the nature of art itself is different in your way of thinking about it if you think art is utilitarian. So what I want to do is produce a painting that will make people think of happy, warm places and of how beautiful this can be. So that's fine if it's just reminiscent of the beauty of nature. That's excellent. And that's what some people would say makes art art. But for somebody who would go a step beyond that, they would say, well, it's not the part that's replicating the reality that's art. It's the part where the artist is expressing whatever it is that was coming out of them in the presence of that reality. For instance, it could have been generated by that, could have been generated by something else entirely. But it's what is conveying the aesthetic experience of the artist in the art, you know, that's giving it this artistic value. Okay, anyway, enough swimming around in that morass. The idea of the nature of art, then, is that it's expressive and it's relatable and it's subtle. But let me explain why subtlety comes into it, then, at this point. Because if all I do is just say to you, jump, and you jump, there's nothing artistic in that at all. If, and I'll give, this is a weird example, I wouldn't really consider this significant or sophisticated art, but if instead of that I create a horror house, you know, what do you call them, fried house, you know what I'm talking about, the Halloween type places, a haunted house, if I create a haunted house and I bring you in and I stun you with a surprised reaction and you jump, that the difference between those two things, where I engendered a response, but it wasn't just rational, it wasn't just creating some awareness of information and then doing something as a result of it, is part of the difference of what I'm talking about. And in art, the thing that beauty drives you to, the response that beauty compels in you, gives you an opportunity to respond to things, to interact with ideas that you have not already processed, that you don't already understand. And when I'm confronting you with words that explain things to you, then that's good. And I'm giving you an opportunity rationally to interpret and understand and then apply and make some choices and do all the stuff that goes with being a rational being in the world. That's fine. But if with art, I can generate a wave inside of you, I can create a vibration inside of you, I can somehow stir a fog inside of you that then comes out in a form that makes you confront something you'd never thought of before or you'd never realized could be what it is before, then I may be able to get you to see something or encounter some idea in a way that's richer, deeper, more meaningful, more impactful, I don't know which way it'll come out, than you've ever experienced it before. That's what art has the ability to do, but only if it's not rationally direct. The rationally direct part requires that you already had all the facilities to understand it. The artistic part that's subtle means I might be able to sneak in behind you and get you to see something you never even considered before. This is part of the beauty of art. And so this is the second part of what we need to talk about, by the way, that art has this importance to it because of several different things, but one of them is just human nature. We are more than rational beings. And there are all kinds of things that are non-rational about our existence. But I can guarantee you the non-rational things are more important than the rational part of our existence in all of our reality. again, that doesn't mean the rational part's not essential. It is essential. I am not quite, but really close to Aristotelian in my thinking and Cartesian in my thinking about how important reason is to our fulfillment of what we're supposed to be as human beings. I mean, in Aristotle's world, we're animals in his way of seeing the world. You know, we're just like animals in every other way. We're biological and we eat, we do all the stuff animals do. The thing that sets us apart from animals is reason, which doesn't mean reason is the most significant portion of our being in terms of, I don't know, the mass it would occupy if we could give a certain amount of space to each component of our existence. It may not be the most significant in any of those ways, but in the way that allows us to rise above being what everything else is and therefore fulfill our nature, our essential identity, the purpose for which we exist, requires us to act on reason. I pretty much agree with Aristotle about that. And yet I'm sitting here telling you that in all of our existence, it's the non-rational stuff that really controls. And I don't even mean this in a negative way, controls us. I just mean that really drives our lives and gives texture and meaning and richness to our lives. So for instance, if you just want to understand how much more than rational we are, think about what counselors go through. And I know that in counseling, you can use rational tools. You can sit down and explain something and go through all the things that just say, hey, do you understand what's happening? If you understand it, let's talk through it and figure out an approach, and we'll generate a plan, and we'll follow the plan, and we'll come to a rational conclusion that solves this problem. That's Jim Dandy. And I believe that can work at times. I understand that. I've never done real counseling. You know what I mean by that? Strictly counseling. But I have done a lot of pastoral counseling over the decades. And in my experience and in my conversations with counselors who are professional counselors, Daisy's a professional counselor now. She's sitting over there producing this show and wishing she could do a little bit of counseling with me right this moment. The point is, in all of my understanding of counseling, the least effective tool, in my experience, is the rational. And if you say, well, I don't think that's true, then I would say you've probably never dealt with a drug addict. Because if you sit down and talk with a drug addict all day long and explain everything that's going on and make sure they understand it completely and can write a full essay about it, and express the essay fully and repeat it over and over and over and over and over again, you're not going to even get close to addressing the actual addiction that is debilitating their life. It's just not a rational problem, and there's not a rational solution. If you find someone who has issues in their parentage, they've had conflicts, abuses from their parents, for instance, I can just tell you, sitting down and explaining it can be helpful. I've done that. I've done it with people who responded extremely well to it. But it doesn't make it go away. It does not change that innate. I know innate's not quite the technically correct term because it's not born into you. But that visceral response that you have when you're in the presence of someone who had that much power in your life at a certain point. It takes more than reason to get past some of those barriers. Sibling rivalry doesn't make sense. I can explain it, but it still doesn't make it go away. Or, I mean, for crying out loud, road rage. What possible sense does road rage make? All you're trying to do is get from one point to another point. And now you want to have major conflicts with all of humanity about their driving habits? Where does that come from? Not reason. Because we're not predominantly rational beings. And if that's the case, then those non-rational parts of who we are hugely important. Now, equally importantly here, let me say, not everything that's non-rational in us is aesthetic. It's not all about aesthetics. And I'll just give you a couple of examples. In the world that we are talking about aesthetics, there's a companion that goes with it. It's called axiology in general, this broad category that includes aesthetics. It's the world of values. It's where we give value to things. This thing is more beautiful than that thing. Ethics fits the same category. This thing is more desirable to do. It is right, and that thing is wrong. We're assigning values to things, axios, the Greek root to the word value. It's worth something. That world isn't a rational world. You just do or don't like stuff. Well, I don't like broccoli. Well, you're not very smart, are you? I didn't say I wouldn't eat it. I didn't say I don't, didn't, I know it. I don't believe it has roughage. I didn't say any of that. I know it's valuable. I know I should like it. I just don't like it, which is not true, by the way. Treated correctly, I can like a piece of broccoli. Okay, getting past that. Something I've had to deal with over my life, obviously. Anyway, the point is, axiological stuff just is. It's not rational. And sociological stuff is the same way. Personal relationships aren't rational.
Well, let me see. I've got these 12 characteristics. They have these 13. Those should fit together nicely. I think this relationship's going to work out perfectly. Let's go. We've got a rational solution here.
That doesn't work for anyone. And the same thing with social structures. You can try to top-down design something economically. You can try to comprehend an ethos intellectually, but you will fail. And that this is why central planning, the idea of central planning to someone who's more libertarian, at least in their economic thinking, I am, more libertarian, the idea of central planning is just anathema. And part of the reason for that is not that we don't think we should do more to be equitable. I think we should do more to be equitable, to be just, to overcome some of the barriers in society that prevent people from experiencing the things that others experience freely. I think we ought to do something about that. My problem with central planning isn't that I don't want to help make society better. My problem with central planning is that we just really don't have the intellectual tools to do it very well. We make a mess of things. We convert power from one center to another center, and therefore convert abuses from one form to another form. We don't really solve the problem. Okay, back on the path here. Aesthetics fits in that category, the part of us that's not purely rational, but is hugely important to us. Important enough that when we're in its presence, we wish we could be there all the time. And we're thinking to ourselves in the presence of beauty that this is what it's supposed to be like, that this is the thing I've been looking for. That kind of response tells you how important to human nature the aesthetic experience is, and therefore art is for bringing us into that experience. So there's the human nature part of why art is important. Second part of why it's important is because of the shared experience we have with art. Art, when it works, when we experience it in the way that produces this aesthetic experience for us, art creates an awareness of our empathy mechanism, of the thing in us that makes us understand other people. I can't see Guernica. I think that's how you would pronounce it, the Picasso piece. The Picasso piece, I think it's on display here in the United States now. It's at a famous museum in the United States now. But it's this giant piece where Picasso is displaying the consequences of the Spanish Civil War or a certain bombing that took place during that period of Spanish history and its catastrophic results in the agony, the suffering of the people who were there, and the destruction to Spain and its nature as a culture. And it's just, I can't look at that without empathizing with the people who were affected, not just by that event at Guernica, but by the whole Spanish Civil War period, by all the things that were going on then, the whole conflict with the fascists and so on. And I wish I knew more about it. But when I look at that painting, I am drawn into empathy with other people. And it's not like I stand in the presence of that painting and I'm just looking at the butchery that took place in Europe during that era of European history. It's not that, because it's a beautiful piece. But when I am looking at it, my aesthetic experience in the presence of that piece attaches me to the rest of humanity and to what has been experienced by that part of humanity. So when art is successful, it does open up this part of us that's empathetic, that connects us with other people, partially because we know they experience beauty in the same way. And we know they need someone to make sense of catastrophic experiences also. And we'll talk more about that later, because it's odd that painful experiences being expressed by an artist would generate in us a desire to be in their presence, that we have an aesthetic experience in that presence. But it's not because we want to experience the pain. It's because we're being drawn to the beauty, and the beauty of it is in the intentionality this artist was able to give to a response to something so otherwise chaotic, frenetic, meaningless, destructive. But now it's been put on a canvas for everyone to remember, for everyone to see, and it's been put there by the hand of a person who, whether they succeeded or not, intended to make something meaningful out of it. Something, even if it's just the communication of it from one generation to the next. Art success automatically connects us empathetically with other people in the world. Not just, again, not just rationally, but empathetically. And art success is emotional. If you could find words, you know, when you're generating things for the internet, a lot of times you'll put a picture on something and it will generate a caption for it, right? So, not a caption, that's not what I mean. It will generate a substitute wording in case someone's not able to see the picture. So if they have a poor internet connection, it won't download the picture. This was common when I was starting out doing things for the web, because everybody had modems and, you know, maybe they connected, maybe they didn't. And so maybe they got the picture, maybe they didn't, but they'd get this set of words. Well, this is and I'm looking right now at an image of Jeff Koons' balloon dog when I'm saying this. And so it'll say, well, this is an image of a balloon dog that is enormous and copper-colored and actually made of metal, shiny in a city street. You know, I can say all of those words, but you're not experiencing Jeff Koons' balloon dog if you're not looking at Jeff Koons' balloon dog. I'm not experiencing his balloon dog if I'm just looking at a picture of it, by the way. But in the same sense, I mean, replacing it with words is a huge step further away from the aesthetic experience of it. You can describe it all day long, and none of the words become the image. If you can close your eyes and generate an accurate image of it in your own mind, imagination, that's the whole idea, then maybe you can experience some of it from those words, but it's by converting those words into the image. The point is, the words are not the same thing. And in that same sense, I'm saying, being able to explain a piece of art is not the same thing as having the emotional experience you have when you're in its presence. That aesthetic experience is different. So art success can be empathetic and emotional and reach those parts of you that are not just rational. By the way, one of the things that makes art unsuccessful is when the experience that you have in its presence is not commensurate with the experience either the artist had or others would have had in the presence of that piece of art. And I'll explain this one, and then we will sort of wrap up the discussion for today, because I know we're starting to run short on time. But also, I will take it up the next show, the next episode, so that we can finish at least this part of the discussion. Because what I need to do is get to the point of explaining why you can have a shared experience, so in the presence of one piece of art, and yet have a completely different reaction to it. I'm revulsed by this. Oh, I'm really drawn towards it. Why do you have that experience in the presence of the same piece of art and not just say, well, you know, art doesn't, I mean, it's not even doing anything. It's just in the person. It's purely subjective. That's not the case. There is value in the art itself. There is content in the art itself. The art itself does generate something. And yet it is true at the same moment that you can have a different experience than somebody else has in the presence of that art. And there's a reason for that that's not difficult to understand. It just takes a few minutes to kind of explain it. And you can imagine what a few minutes means for me. So we'll get there. But that will be the next episode. What I want to end with here is sort of an explanation of what I mean by when art can fail. And that's when we have an incommensurate experience, an experience that's not like someone else would have in the presence of that art, and especially what the artist themselves, you know, were communicating. And again, it's not, we're not just replicating an artist's experience. That's not it at all. I'll explain that when we talk about it next time. But a perfect example of a magnificent piece of art, it's a poem, that is completely lost in translation from one culture to another. And it's my favorite example, I've given it before in previous episodes, is the Iliad, the poem, the Iliad, you know, the epic poem. The Achilles in the Iliad, and not all of it's lost, but this part is absolutely, because I've done this with students for a long time, and nobody gets it. And even when the Iliad was made into some kind of movie, I can't remember, it's a Brad Pitt movie of some kind or another, long time ago. Wasn't even, I'm not even recommending it. I'm not even telling you to go look at it. It had zero impact because they really did try to stay true to the story, as I understand it. And the truth is, the story doesn't connect. The characters do not connect because the values of that culture are so fundamentally different than the values of our culture. And the short example of that is Achilles. Achilles is the great hero of Greek culture. I mean, he is the warrior. He's the warrior of warriors. He's David in their culture, right? Dave, what David is, killing Goliath, that's what Achilles is. Able to defeat anyway. He's the great warrior. Okay. So when the Iliad is about the Greeks going to war at Troy, right? Ilion. So they're going to go to fight this great battle. And by the time they get there, Agamemnon has ticked off Achilles because he's taken his woman away, right? So Achilles is sulking about that. And so he refuses to go into the battle. He's not going to go into the battle. His friends are dying on the battlefield because he's not there. They're bringing him reports about how they're being defeated by the Trojans because he's not there. And he sits in his tent and sulks because Agamemnon had taken his woman. It's a complicated story about the woman, but we don't care. The point is, he's sulking about it. Well, I'm not going to go fight until Agamemnon apologizes to me. This is how we interpret it, because he's acting like a baby. His friends are dying in battle, and he's not going in because Agamemnon made him mad. Agamemnon's the great king over the Greek. He's the one, the Greeks, he's the one that's leading the battle for them. And he's not going to go and support Agamemnon until Agamemnon comes and makes things right and restores his pride. He's been shamed by Agamemnon. We say to ourselves, oh, what a ridiculous person. I mean, what a self-centered egoist. But that's not what the Greeks were saying. You don't read this story in ancient Greece and think to yourself, yeah, if he would just get up and go fight, they could go ahead and win the battle. What you're thinking to yourself for them is, he has been shamed, and his honor has been taken away from him. And there's no sense in him going to fight for a culture that's shaming him, because the most important thing in that culture is honor. And his honor has to be restored. And he's being courageous by making the choice to demand that honor be held in the appropriate light in their world. We don't sense that at all. We just see a spoiled brat sitting in his tent. And so we read the story in a completely different light. So what I mean when I say art sometimes fails is sometimes it's not the artist. It's not like the artist has made a mistake of some kind or did something wrong. I mean, they're just expressing what they're expressing. But it can fail in us if we don't have a connection to the mechanisms that would generate the aesthetic experience in us that they're supposed to generate. So if this is as far as we're going to get today, then I just want to pause with this. And I know we didn't get a long ways, but there are a couple of things that I really want to accomplish next time that I hope will help you begin to appreciate why you can stand in front of a piece of art and have a legitimate aesthetic experience in front of that piece of art, and yet it be different from someone else and what they experience, and yet it be from the art, not just saying, well, you just feel what you feel. Just stand in front of a wall and just have whatever feelings you want to have. It's not that. This is genuine art producing an experience in you that comes because the artist expressed what they did, because the art is what it is, and because God made you to be the person who can interact with that beauty. I want us to be the kind of people that where God can use any piece of beauty in the world, any piece of art in the world, to drive us closer to what he made us to be and to understand therefore better who he is to us. So more next time.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.